Welcome to episode 35 of The Mental Breakdown. I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Good morning. Friday
Good
morning. Here we are again.
Another Friday.
Now, Richard, we try to be here week in and week out, every Friday morning.
Right.
We're building this routine. Now, we're still building the routine because it's 8:20 and we always like to start at 8 o'clock.
Right.
But we're here nonetheless. And we are ready to go because we're building routines.
Our routine is flexible.
That's right. We have a flexible routine. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons why it's still flexible is because we're working to change some of our habits. And so today's podcast is all about change. How we create change in our life. And it's really timely, of course, with the first of the year coming.
Good time to do it because all of us are looking forward to the holidays. And then we have all those resolutions that we're going to make in January. All the improvements that we plan to make in the coming year,
right,
and the many New Year's resolutions that we vow to keep this year. Unlike the years past where we didn't keep our resolutions, we're going to keep them this time.
That's right. And, you know, I think that we have on our schedule to talk about New Year's resolutions next week. And so today is sort of a primer. We're getting ready for it because today's podcast called Change is all about just that. It's all about change. And I think that the way that we're going to approach it, we're going to talk about it from almost the biopsychosocial model. There's some biology behind change. There's some psychology behind change, and certainly our environment and relationships affect change. Mm-hmm. So
that's really true. It is a biopsychosocial phenomenon,
right?
Like so many things we talk about.
Exactly.
But the idea here is that I think the main theme is that change is difficult.
Yes.
Yeah, we want to talk about, and we acknowledge that. I think what we want to do is begin with, you know, we laugh about not keeping our resolutions, but it really is serious business because change does not occur easily. It takes effort. It's a very effortful process that takes time and effort. And that's what we want to talk about this morning.
Yeah, let's start there. Why is it so difficult to change? And that's a great question. And, you know, our patients ask us that all the time. You know, I want to change this, and yet I fall right back into doing what I was doing before. Or, you know, I want to change this aspect of my life, and it seems like I just keep doing the same thing over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why change is so difficult is because much of our life has been built out of habit. You know, we get up pretty much the same time every morning. We do pretty much the same thing every morning. We have the same routines throughout the day. We have the same evening routines. And, you know, one of the things we do when we're doing evaluations and talking with patients, it's one of our first questions is, okay, so what is your afternoon routine? Mm-hmm. And invariably, parents will say, parents or patients will say, well, you know, I typically do this, this, and this. Sometimes I go by the store, but we have this general set of activities that we use every day, that we do every day. And our whole life is built out of habit like that. And when we have habits, well, there's some important things that we need to talk about with habits. Okay, so when we think about habits, we tend to think about you know, our hobbies and things that we do. But really, habits serve a very important psychological process. Habits relieve anxiety. Habits make us feel comfortable. When you are stressed, invariably, you tend to resort to some habit that you have that relieves that stress. Whatever that habit may be, that habit may be a good habit, like going for a walk or getting some exercise. Or that habit may be more maladaptive and you may eat junk food or you may sit and watch TV for hours to help relieve your anxiety. But when we're stressed, we tend to resort to habits to make us feel better, to help relieve some of that stress.
Sort of automatic behaviors,
right,
rather than effortful, mindful proactive behavior.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so, it's usually these negative habits, these negative behaviors that we want to change. Those are the behaviors that we want to modify. So let's take, for example, the example we were just using. So when you perhaps when you're stressed, you're the type of person who eats poorly. And so you want to change that habit by saying, I don't want to eat poorly anymore. I don't want to eat junk food. Well, what you're trying to change is you're trying to change a habit. And habits are habits for a reason. They are sort of automatic, like you just said. They're automatic behaviors. They're automatic things that we do. And so they are difficult to change, to stop doing. And we're going to get to the stop piece. So I use that word very specifically for a reason, and we'll get there in a moment. Much of this is rooted from early, we could even say early humans, but early in our development. We have systems in our brain that facilitate, that encourages us, that pushes us, drives us to create habits. Our brain wants routine. Our brain likes when we do the same kinds of things over and over again. Now, there are conditions, psychological conditions, developmental conditions, where that's not true. And for that reason, they're developmental conditions, like ADHD. ADHD is a disorder where the person is constantly seeking novelty. They want stimulation. They want some excitement. So how many times have you seen a child with ADHD who may be doing something really exciting, but they say it's boring? And the reason it's boring is because I did it yesterday, or I did it the day before, or I do it every day. So even something that's fun and exciting can be deemed boring because of the ADHD brain.
Right.
But for most of us who don't have ADHD, our brain wants habit. Our brain wants routine. And so once we find routine, whether it's adaptive or maladaptive, our brain tends to stick with it. And that is a very deep brain system. That's way down in there. And that's a brain system that's sort of an attribute that we share with many other animals in the animal kingdom. Those regions of our brain are very consistent across different animals. And that's why hunters, for example, can go and they can sort of scout out an area where they want to hunt because deer follow a particular pattern. They walk in a similar way. If you ever drove by a cow pasture or something, you can see lines in the pasture where the cows tend to walk every day to and from their destination. So most animals seek habit. They want to do the same thing because that relieves stress, that sort of removes the need to think about some of those things that we need to do.
That's right. And for those of you who are listening to this podcast, you can get a general sense of where this is going. And that is that we're going to talk about change in terms of what our brain is doing, right?
Right.
I mean, that's where we're headed. The reason change is so difficult is because of the way our brains tend to work. But this larger topic is about why we do what we do.
Right.
Why do we do the things that we do? And why is it so difficult to change those things? And when we ask the question, why do we do the things that we do? One of the earliest, because you're talking about habits.
Correct.
One of the earliest explanations, and this was 100 years ago, one of the earliest explanations of why we do what we do is because we develop habits.
Right.
And we tend to do the things that we do. We tend to do things in the same way over and over again. You know,
right.
Our morning rituals, our evening rituals, our church rituals, our school rituals. We tend to do things in a habitual way. And that's why we do things. Later on, the behaviorists like Skinner and Watson said, well, no, we do things because we get reinforced for it. Because
right.
for some reason, we get something for doing the things that we do. But as we move along, as we've begun to understand how the brain works, now the explanation is a brain-based explanation of we do the things we do because this is the way our brain works.
Right.
So we're sort of taking everybody up to the present explanation of why we do the things that we do.
Right.
And why it's so difficult to change these habits that we develop over time.
Right.
Right? Okay.
And you know, when we teach psychological theory at the undergraduate and graduate level, you know, we talk about these different theories, whether it's Freud's theory, Freud's psychosexual developmental theory, Skinner's behavioral theory, or Beck's cognitive theory, or whatever the theory, they all seem so different.
Right.
But at its root, they're all really the same.
Exactly.
And let's use an example really quickly. There's a region in our brain, one of our favorite regions of the brain, called the limbic system.
Right.
And the limbic system is where most of your emotions and memories and things like that. That's the area of our brain that really seeks hedonistic pleasures. It wants to be in a state of ecstasy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that state of ecstasy is romantic or whether it's rageful. Mm-hmm. You know, rage comes from the same centers of our brain that love comes from.
Right.
And so that's our limbic system. So from a biological perspective, there's this region deep inside our brain. Some call it even the reptilian brain, right? Because reptiles, that's the majority of the reptile brain. They are just focused on eating and survival.
Right. Because
the things that
That's right.
keep them going.
The limbic system consists of a collection of structures that are devoted largely to the survival of the individual and the survival of the species.
Right.
Okay? And so they are these, we call them deep brain structures. They're underneath the cortex, and they either generate emotion or they inhibit emotion.
Right.
But these are the emotional engines,
yes.
If you will, of our brain, are these 10 or 12 structures that comprise this cluster in the middle of our brain.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who are Star Trek fans, it looks like the Klingon bird of prey. That's how it's shaped, with the sort of the center of the vehicle right in the middle of your brain, and the wings kind of going into the two lobes, the right and left hemisphere of our brain. So it's really a fascinating structure. But the way that we're describing it, what it also sounds like is this is Freud's id.
That's the id. That's what Freud described it. Yeah.
Yeah. Freud described the id as this underlying subconscious
right.
motivation, drive
yeah.
for pleasure.
Yeah. People often forget that Freud was a neurologist
right.
by training, and he understood how the brain worked. And so when he talks about id, ego, and superego, he was talking about these subcortical structures. He knew they existed,
right.
and he knew what they did. I mean, he had a pretty good idea of what they did, and so it's not surprising that he would develop this concept of the id.
Right, right. And so those underlying drives, and if we talk about it from a cognitive behavioral model, we'll be talking about impulse. These are your impulses that are driving some of this. So despite the theory that we really approach this from, we're really talking about the same thing.
Right.
And it is these deep, and the real key important part of it is that it doesn't require thought.
Right.
These are structures that function outside of the cortex. Now,
that's right.
When we think about the human brain, the wrinkly part, that's what makes us human. You know,
right.
everything underneath the wrinkly part, and the wrinkly part is only a few millimeters thick.
Yeah, it's only 3 millimeters thick.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Those underlying parts of our brain are not too dissimilar from any other animal.
Right.
And
yeah,
so
all animals have them.
Right.
You know, they all have these structures.
Right. Mm-hmm. Of different sizes. And so we have strengths and weaknesses of different mm-hmm. things. But yeah, absolutely. So these are structures. These are theories, whether it's the id, impulse, the limbic mm-hmm. system, however we describe it. These are all things that are below conscious thought.
That's right.
And, you know, so when we think about, like, it's like a reflex. You know, you don't think about kicking your leg when the doctor hits your knee. It just happens. And that's what a lot of this thing is, a lot of these things are. And this is the go system. All right. So if we just sort of make it, sort of break it down to a very fundamental two-letter word, it's the go system.
Okay. So the limbic system, where all these drives are.
Right.
Okay. That's what's driving. That's what's motivating us.
Right.
Okay. To keep our bodies warm, to keep our bodies fed, to keep our bodies hydrated.
Right.
These are all basic drives. They all exist in the limbic system.
Correct.
And they're always moving us to satisfy them.
Yes.
Okay. So that we're going to call the go system.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because it's always impelling us to do something. And
right.
then the cortex inhibits the ones that it needs to inhibit.
In particular, the frontal lobe
right.
of the cortex,
right. okay.
the what we call the prefrontal cortex. And if you think about how the brain, if you think about that classic image of the brain, the part that sort of loops around just above our eyes in the skull, right. That area of our brain right there is what is intended to inhibit those underlying go impulses. The problem is that it's a losing battle, really. I mean, if we really get down to it,
right.
The frontal lobe, especially the frontal lobe, the cortex in general, but especially the prefrontal cortex, is very, very new from an evolutionary perspective. I mean, this is compared to the limbic system, our prefrontal cortex is an infant. And so it has a lot of work to do to make up for the impulses and drives of the limbic system and those underlying impulsive drives. But it does, you know, for a lot of us, our prefrontal cortex does a pretty good job most of the time in inhibiting those impulses. So when you're at work and somebody says something and you really want to snap back at them, and that prefrontal cortex says, no, I know it will feel really good to say that right now. The consequences of that later on, so this is your ego, this is Freud's ego, your ego says, nope, that's not a very good idea. Let's not do that. That's going to cause you problems.
So on a day-to-day basis, you use the term battle, this contest.
Yes.
In a very real sense, you have this contest between the emotional structures trying to satisfy themselves.
Right.
And this cortex, that covers it, that's over these structures.
Right.
I wish you could see my hands as I'm talking about this.
I can see them.
It would make more sense. You have this cortex that's constantly trying to inhibit, especially the negative impulses.
Right.
You have an impulse to scratch somebody's eyes out,
right.
But you have the inhibitory mechanisms of the frontal lobe, which say, no, that's not a good idea.
Right.
So in the course of the day, you have these two things constantly battling each other for control of your behavior.
Right.
Okay.
And as we said before, it's not really a fair battle.
No.
And it's not a fair battle because the limbic system, again, is, and we'll just call it the go system. The go system is really driven by the habits that we were talking about.
Right. And survival.
Survival. Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And habits are often developed based upon survival. Right. So, you know, when we feel like, if we're in a particular situation and we feel like we have to respond in a way to quote unquote survive,
right.
We're going to continue to behave that way.
Right.
You know, on a very fundamental level, if you feel stressed, your body may feel like to survive, I need to eat that chocolate cake because it's going to relieve this stress that I'm experiencing right now. On a biological basis, you know, intensity levels may vary, though for some people it won't. The stress from a hard day at work is not really that different than the stress of being in a war or being anywhere else from a fundamental perspective.
From a biological perspective, stress is stress. Doesn't matter what the source of it is.
Right.
The stress can be from hunger. It can be from being in a bad mood. It can be from being insulted by somebody or being shot at by somebody.
Right.
Stress is stress.
Right. Now, the intensity levels do vary. And so we don't want to minimize, you know, what it's like to be in war, of course.
Right.
But from a biological perspective, the way that your brain is responding to these things, stress is stress is stress.
That's right.
That's it. And so for your body to say, hey, the last time I was experiencing stress like this, that chocolate cake really made me feel good. Right. And those things, again, begin very early in life. You know, when, you know, if you grow up in an area or with a parent or with a family member who, you know, when you're distressed, when the family's stressed out, hey, I know what, you know, we had a rough day at school today. We had a rough day at work today. Let's go to Dairy Queen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're building the habit of satisfying and dealing with stress with food,
right.
And especially high carb, high sugar,
high
calorie foods.
Mm-hmm.
And so that begins a habit that lasts for the rest of your life, that can last for the rest of your life.
Yeah. We've had a bad day, so let's go have an apple.
Yeah. Nobody says that.
No, you go have a donut or ice cream or some festive food.
And again, from a biological perspective, it's because it works. I mean, you know, those satisfying foods release dopamine in your brain, right, which makes your limbic system feel good.
The simple sugars get your serotonin up. You know, and so, okay. So biologically, it makes sense.
It makes sense. It's maladaptive.
Right.
It's not good for you.
Right.
But it works.
Right.
And so these habits become ingrained from very early in life, from those very early decisions that we make and those very early experiences that we have. And so we are really motivated. These habits become a motivation. And when we talk to people who have these bad behaviors, they talk as though they don't have control over it.
Right.
It just happens. Right. You know, when I talk with patients and we talk about, you know, wanting to cut back sugar, or we talk about wanting to eat better, you know, they say, you know, I do okay up to a point, and then it's like the dam breaks and all of a sudden, you know, we're just eating everything in the house that has just a little bit of that high fructose corn syrup in it, because it's just so good. Even though it's so bad for us.
But it's so satisfying.
It
satisfies those cravings.
Right. Right. And it's because we're motivated to do that. And, you know, we've talked before about motivation. And this is an intrinsic biological motivation. Our body wants it because we have demonstrated in the past that it's effective in dealing with this stress, because it has become a habit.
Right.
That's the power of habit.
Right.
There's no thought required. There's no decision making to happen. It just happens. Now, it's a decision from the point of you got to get up from the living room and go into the kitchen to get it. But at the same time, it's almost like it happens involuntarily. Mm-hmm. Before you know it, you're not eating a rice cake. You're not eating an apple, like you said. You're eating a Snickers bar, or you're eating ice cream. And you get in there and you say, there's no reason for me to put this ice cream into a bowl. I'm just going to take the tub with me in there and watch a TV eating this tub of ice cream.
And eat until I'm satisfied.
Right.
Right. So, but you're driven by your brain to do this. I mean, we acknowledge. I mean, what we're saying to you here is that we get it. You are really driven by these subcortical structures to satisfy this urge. And,
right.
And we know how powerful that urge is.
Yes.
That impels you to the refrigerator or to the cupboard or to wherever your stash of goodies might be.
Right.
These are basic biological drives that are tied to satisfying important needs.
Right.
And things that we feel.
Right. And again, just to be clear, it's because your body says, I need this to survive.
Right. That's right. This is a survival.
That's the motivation.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. So
that happened to me last night. I had eaten properly all day. Everything was fine. But for some reason, I just felt this urge to continue eating. And it was really a tough battle to make it to bedtime, because there was something really driving me to the kitchen last night. I don't know why it happened last night, but it just creeps up on you. And I was like in a feeding frenzy, and I had to be very, very careful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if you're not, then you end up eating more or eating things that you otherwise wouldn't, and then you have guilt later on and your frustration later on.
Yeah, because when you're driven to eat that, you say, well, I must need it. You know,
right.
This is so strong in me that I must need it, so I should satisfy this craving, because obviously I need it, okay? Well, you probably don't. You can probably make it until morning without it, but that's the way it makes you feel, that I have to satisfy this. I must need something in this donut.
Right.
My body is craving it so much that I must need some. But actually, that's your brain sort of playing tricks on you.
Right.
You
know? Right. And again, based upon everything we're saying, it's not that it's wrong.
Mm-mm.
It's not that your brain is incorrect. Mm-mm. It's that is the bad habit that your brain has been utilizing to deal with the stress.
You're going to the go-to system.
Yes.
You know, what's the go-to?
What's the
go-to here?
That's the easy way out. Let's just deal with
it
that way.
It's the easy way to satisfy this thing. Not the only way. It's the easiest and the most compelling way.
Especially when the donuts are sitting there on the table.
Especially when they're there.
Right.
That's right.
So, okay. So with that as sort of our basis. Go ahead.
But if you had to drive an hour to get the donuts.
Right.
They wouldn't be nearly as compelling.
Right.
And that's what you have to remind yourself, that I'm only eating these because they're here.
Right.
If I had to get dressed, get in the car, drive to the store, which is open 24 hours a day, so I have to drive across town, and then come home and eat them, I don't need them that badly.
Right.
And that's your key, that right. you don't need it as badly as you think you do.
Right, right. So if we could develop a system where you could say, before you eat anything, you say, would I drive an hour to eat this?
And that's why we tell people, don't bring it into your house.
Right.
If it's not in the house, you're going to have to go through this process,
right.
and you're going to talk. Then you can talk yourself out of it and say, "No, it's really not that important."
Right. Mm-hmm. And so then we get to shopping habits and all that kind of stuff. So
comes later.
We need to write all this stuff down. So how do we change these habits? How do we create change? That's
knowing
what this
what
podcast
we know,
is all about.
Knowing what we know about the brain.
Right.
Knowing what we know about habits. How do we then change those habits?
Right. And again, that's where our also important prefrontal cortex comes into play, mm-hmm. Or again, Freud's ego comes into play. We have to booster that. Now, I've already mentioned it a couple of times. It really is likely a losing battle for the prefrontal cortex. The prefrontal
cortex. Well, it's a difficult battle.
It's a difficult battle.
Right.
The reason I say the
deck is stacked against the frontal cortex.
Right.
Right.
The reason that I say that it's a potentially, I should say potentially losing battle, is because whereas the subcortical systems are so innate, they are so just an automatic happening. I mean, when we think about one more thing about these these subcortical structures, you know, you don't think about your heart beating. You don't think about breathing. Mm-hmm. They just happen. Mm-hmm. Now, try to think as hard as you can and see if you can make your heart stop.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You can't. Because those subcortical structures function outside of our cognitive control. They just happen. They have, in video game terms, they have a cheat where they have infinite life. They have infinite energy. It just keeps going. Our prefrontal cortex, however, has a limited, now that the amount that it can hold will vary, but it has a relatively limited amount of energy. It has a relatively limited amount of fuel that it can use to do its job.
And it also needs to rest periodically.
Yes.
The subcortical emotional structures, those go structures that we talked about earlier, they don't seem to need a rest.
Right.
But the cortex, the inhibitors, they seem to need to take a break occasionally.
Right.
Right.
Because in fact, the more fatigued we are, mm-hmm. the more likely we are for those subcortical structures to activate.
To win. Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's why I say it's a potentially losing battle unless we're careful about it, because mm-hmm. Because the prefrontal cortex has a finite amount of energy mm-hmm. to use. And we can't really measure it. We can't go in and say, oh, well, you got a half a tank. You need to go into the service station and get a refill.
So what you're asking the frontal lobe to inhibit your emotions. But your frontal lobe has a limited amount of inhibitory energy.
Right.
And once that's used up, then it's more likely that the emotional, these emotional surges are going to break through.
Right.
Are going to appear. Right.
And so let's think about evidence of that. Okay. Mm-hmm. How many times do we talk to parents, adults, who say, I make it through the day just fine. My kid makes it through the day just fine. But at about 6 or 7 o'clock at night, things begin to deteriorate. When we worked in the residential facilities and in the hospitals and stuff, we call it the sundown syndrome.
Right.
You know, it seemed like when the sun goes down, all of the behaviors start to emerge.
And the emotional things begin to come
right.
out. Right.
The night shift at working at the hospital or the residential centers is the most difficult shift because of this sundown syndrome. Well, what we're talking about happens, that's happening during that time, is that for a lot of these people, their prefrontal cortex has expended all of its energy throughout the day to inhibit. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we get into the evening, there's no more fuel left.
Right.
And so all of those emotional, behavioral, impulses now are going to seep through.
Are those all those survival instincts
right.
that tell you you need to eat, you need to drink, you need to do this, you need to do that. All those things now have a better chance of getting through the
right.
inhibitory system, the inhibitory net, because the inhibition now has decreased.
Right.
That energy has gone down. But the limbic system energy has not gone down to the same extent that the inhibitory has.
Right, right, right. Mm-hmm. It just continues to push through. And so as soon as we become fatigued neuropsychologically,
neurologically, right.
Those underlying systems are able to get breakthrough. And that's why we have so many behavioral issues at night.
At night.
I hated
mm-hmm.
working the night shift
mm-hmm.
Because it was so challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why. So that's sort of evidence that, in fact, we do have a relatively finite amount of mm-hmm. inhibitory stop energy.
Mm-hmm.
We have a relatively little amount of energy to inhibit those underlying systems. With that in mind, how do we deal with this? How do we help make change when there's so much seemingly working against us?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, our brain, for lack of a better word, our brain is sort of working against us.
It
in
really
this situation.
Is. I mean, and that's what we need to understand, that your brain is working against you. I mean, the biological mechanisms that are going on in your brain all the time are really working against you, and that's why it takes effort. That's
mm-hmm.
why change takes effort, because your brain is pushing you in another direction,
right.
and you have to keep pulling it back.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And think about this, because everyone has experienced this. You know, happily married, and you're in Publix or you're in the grocery store, and you see an attractive person.
Mm-hmm.
There are thoughts that come to you
right.
that you shouldn't have, quote unquote, shouldn't have, because you're happily married, but it's your brain working against you.
Jimmy Carter acknowledged that in a Playboy interview when he was running for president. And he referred to it as having lust in his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he was talking about.
Right.
You know, you see this, and there's this automatic response.
Right.
It's not like you're out looking for it.
Right.
It's just, oh, wow, that's nice.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your brain. That's from those subcortical systems
right.
that they do kind of get up there and say, hey, what do you guys think?
That's right.
You know?
Because those structures are interested in survival of the individual and survival of the species. We're
right.
driven to do that.
Right, right. So our brain is working against us. And so we have to develop procedures. We have to develop a system for building new habits.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that we're saying it by building new habits is because we have to we can't rely solely on our stop system.
Well, you're talking about building new systems to build new habits.
Correct.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So because we can't rely on our stop system, that
no.
prefrontal cortex, we can't completely rely on that to fix everything.
Right.
So while we're using our stop system, we need to develop new strategies for creating the change that we want.
That's right. And while we're on this topic, one thing we want to mention, when you do encounter difficulties making changes, this is difficult, and your troubles are not due to weakness or
right.
moral weakness. I mean, this is a difficult battle that
right.
that we're asking to fight. And so rather than saying, well, I'm just too weak, no. What we're saying is, no, you can build new skills. You can develop new skills to overcome this biological conundrum that we're
exactly.
in.
And one of the ways to do that, and so this is sort of how we'll sort of begin this idea, is instead of recognizing what you want to stop doing,
right.
you need to identify what you're going to do instead. So you're creating a new go. Instead of relying on stop,
right.
you're going to rely on new go. Think about little kids.
Right.
You know, we often joke or wonder why one of the first words our kids learn is no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's because that's all they hear. They hear no, don't do that, stop, don't do that, no, no, no. And so they start saying it right back.
That's right. Children say that. They begin saying that at about age 18, 24 months. Okay?
Right.
That's at the same time that the brain has this explosion of new neurons. So the child's becoming much more competent at the same time.
Right.
Not only have they heard the word no, spoken with emotion, typically.
Mm-hmm.
So when they speak it, they attach the same emotion to it.
Right.
But they're also saying, no, I can do it myself.
Right.
It's also an expression of, I want to do something other than you're asking me to do.
Right, okay. Right. And so, you know, we say no repeatedly. And what we teach in our parenting book, the Handbook for Raising an Emotionally Healthy Child, which the revised version will be available in an e-format sometime in January. We'll give you updates on that.
In the next few weeks, right.
But the way that we talk about in that is, we don't like the word no. I really don't like the word no at all. And the reason is that no doesn't teach anything.
Right.
What you're trying to do is you're trying to get a child who already has an underdeveloped prefrontal cortex because of development, you're trying to force that child to rely on that stop system, that prefrontal right. cortex system, mm-hmm. to inhibit the underlying subcortical structures that yeah. want them to seek pleasure.
Yeah, think about that for a moment. You're asking the child not to satisfy an urge.
Right.
That's all you're saying. You're saying, no, you can't satisfy this urge right now.
Right.
That's why they rebel.
Exactly. And so what we should be doing instead is finding a behavior, is teaching them a behavior to replace it.
Right.
So
yeah, what are they trying to satisfy?
Right.
And how can we get them to satisfy it in a positive way?
Exactly.
Right.
And so a lot of parents do this. So when a kid asks for a cookie, instead mm-hmm. of saying no, you say, I have an idea. Why don't we have an apple for a snack? Mm-hmm. Okay, so you're not saying no because that doesn't teach anything. You're saying mm-hmm. when we feel like we need a snack, here are healthy alternatives. Yeah. And those children are going to develop healthier eating habits and healthier snack choices. But it's the same thing when a child is having a temper tantrum about something. Instead of saying, no, stop that, say, hey, let's do this, or come over mm-hmm. here and look at this, or, well, we can get into ignoring the behavior at another time. But
right.
The best way to deal with those kinds of situations, behaviors that we want to eliminate, is to teach replacement behaviors that is mutually exclusive to the behavior that we want to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can't eat a cookie and an apple at the same time. Well, right. I mean, I guess you could, but we're not going to. Apple flavored cookie would be interesting.
Well, there's another issue too, and that is that when we talk about the child trying to satisfy a need, does the child want a cookie or is the child hungry?
Right.
Huge difference.
Right.
You know, just by teaching, you know, what need is my child trying to express?
Right.
Typically, when they ask for a cookie, they're getting hungry.
Right.
Maybe it's time to have dinner. Maybe
right.
it's time to feed them a meal because the child's hungry. They really don't want a cookie. They want to satisfy their hunger.
That's a fantastic point. So a way to deal with that situation is, Mommy, can I have a cookie? Oh, are you getting hungry? Well, let's go see what we can...
You must
you know,
be
what
hungry.
We can,
right.
What we mm-hmm. can get. So now you're teaching the child to label this... Mm-hmm. internal feeling mm-hmm. as hunger. Okay, so when I feel this way, this means I'm hungry. This means I need to get something
right.
good to
it's
eat.
It's a wonderful thing to teach a two-year-old,
right.
you know, to label things accurately
right.
so that the parent knows what need does my child have.
Right.
Now, it may be to have a cookie.
Right.
But chances are the child's hungry.
Right.
And we want to satisfy that.
Right.
We can do that a number of ways. And we don't have to argue about the cookie.
Right. Right, exactly. What we find is when we stop using the word no,
mm-hmm. yeah, no doesn't.
When we stop relying on the stop system,
right,
and we're teaching new behaviors, what we find is we have fewer arguments, and we have better relationships.
That's right. The problem with no, that would be a good article. The problem with no.
Yeah.
Okay. The problem with no is it doesn't solve anybody's. It doesn't satisfy anybody's need.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that I talk to patients about it and parents about it is that no is a definitive. No is an absolute no.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we want it to be an absolute.
Right.
Right. Sometimes we say no, and then we say no, and then we say no again. And then when they ask the fifth time, we say, okay, just go and get out of my hair, you know.
We say, I've said no 1,000 times.
Right. I mean, no is supposed to be a definitive. So when you say no cookie, is that a definitive?
Mm-hmm.
Or are you really saying not right now? At some point in the future, you may have a cookie, perhaps for dessert. Mm-hmm. But if we say no, we're trying to make a definitive. And that seems to be how children interpret the word no. Mm-hmm. That when you're saying no, that is a definitive, and I don't have any idea when I will ever have the opportunity to have a cookie again.
That's right. You know? Yeah, that might mean no forever.
Right. And I'm going to be really upset about that because I really like cookies.
Right.
So we need to be careful about the word no, because the no, bring it back to what we're talking about today, no focuses on the stop system, which for even adults isn't completely adequate to deal with these underlying motivation systems. Mm-hmm. So the first thing we have to do, as we said, is we have to identify replacement behaviors that satisfy the same need mm-hmm. that we can do repeatedly.
Right.
So when we think about, you know, when I talk to my patients who are trying to eat better and they want to cut back on sugary foods, my first recommendation is, when you have, is fill your refrigerator with fruit. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, there are some people out there who say, well, fruit is not really any much better than candy, but I completely disagree. It's much better than candy. It may not be as good as vegetables, but it's better than candy. But what fruit does, you know that I cut sugar out of my diet, about 5 months ago. Mm-hmm. And it was really difficult because, you know, me before, I love some candy. You know, I could eat it all day, every day.
And you like kid candy. Sour gummies.
Sour Patch Kids are the best. So when I stopped eating sugar, it was really difficult. So what I found is I probably would eat 3 watermelons a week, just getting the cubes from the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And so anytime that I got that craving for sugar, I would just go eat some watermelon or grapes mm-hmm. or... I was in a kick for oranges for a while and a kick with apples for a while. But I would resort to a more natural, more complex sugar as opposed to sticking with the simple high fructose corn syrups and simple sugars that really do some damage to your body. I would resort to the more complex sugars and fruit. And what I found is by just starting or trying to satisfy that urge, that motivation for sugar, made it much easier to create that change.
So rather than battling the no system, these underlying urges, you were satisfying the go system.
Right.
Okay.
I would say, so my go system was saying, we need sugar. And instead of saying no, because I knew that mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to make it, I said, okay, mm-hmm. well, this is what I have available to me.
Right.
And I didn't buy any candy.
Had you had peanut M&Ms in the house, it might have been a different story.
It might have been a different story.
Right.
But I didn't buy those, and so I created new habits. What I had available, and maybe like we were talking about earlier, I didn't feel like it. You know, 10:30 at night, going up to the store to get peanut M&Ms.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what I had available to me was watermelon, and I just made sure that those healthy choices were available that could satisfy that need as well.
Still satisfy it. So, and that's what we mean by not denying the urge. You know, go ahead and satisfy the urge, but satisfy it in a healthy, proactive way, positive way.
Research has consistently shown that as soon as you tell yourself that you can't do something, your underlying drive is to do that.
And it increases the value.
Yes. It mm-hmm. makes it that much more attractive. Even if we know that it's bad for us, it becomes much more attractive to us.
We're willing to take a chance on a couple of M&Ms.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's okay. I want it so badly. I'll risk it. I'll risk gaining a little weight.
Right. You know? Right. Mm-hmm. What is one bag going to do? You know, we say those things.
I was thinking about a handful.
I was talking to somebody. And they, you know, when they had the bag, they would measure how much you were going to eat by the weight of the bag. So if it was a 16-ounce bag, they're like, yeah, it's a pound. I can, you know, I'll just eat half of that.
I'll have a quarter pounder.
You know, it'll be fine, you know? And so it's, we make these excuses and we look for this rationale mm-hmm. to fit these needs, and we don't need to.
Right.
We can replace those behaviors. We can change those behaviors in a much easier way. And I'm mm-hmm. telling you, by eating the fruit, doing what I did, I think that you would agree. Those difficult cravings that was really driving that ended within a couple of weeks.
So you do get rid of those cravings for high fructose corn syrup or high sugar.
Right, right. Okay. You do get rid of them. So it takes a little bit of time depending on how dependent you are on it.
Right.
But, you know, now it's unsweet tea. I don't drink any sodas. I'm able to stay away from all of those things. I would drink 2 or 3 Monster energy drinks a day. Candy, as I already said. But I'm able to stay away from that now. I'm able to make better decisions because I've created new habits. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think that it's what I think is important for those of you listening to understand is that when you want to make change, you can't just say, I'm not going to do this anymore.
Right.
You have to say, I'm going to do this instead and do it repeatedly.
So it's a two-step process.
Right.
One is to make the determination. The second is to build new habits. So
right.
First of all, you have to say, I'm not going to, this is what I'm going to get rid of.
Right.
But then the necessary, and I say necessary, second step is I'm going to replace it with this. I'm not going to deny that I have the craving.
Right.
I'm going to replace it with this.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And, you know, lots of researchers, and what we're talking about is creating new habits. Many times to create new habits, you have to create rituals.
Right.
And what I mean by rituals is you have to find a way to do the same thing repeatedly.
Mm-hmm.
And with the goal of meeting this need. So when you go shopping, you know, you shop in a particular way. You know,
right.
Most people, when they go to the grocery store, they follow a very similar path.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you are analyzing yourself and you're looking at yourself and you're saying, you know, when I follow that path, I know that by the time I get here, my inhibition is so weak that I'm going to put that tub of ice cream in the shopping cart. I'm going to go through that candy aisle anyways, and I'm going to pick up those peanut M&Ms or whatever it is, and I'm going to put those in the cart. If we change that behavior, if we create a new ritual and say, I'm not going to do it that way, I'm going to do it this way, and with some effort, work to change that. Again, not stop it, not say, I'm not going to go down the candy aisle, but say, I know that if I went down the candy aisle first, I would have enough inhibition not to put candy in the cart because that energy level that we were talking about earlier, then you may be able to change some of those behaviors that way. So we have to find new behaviors that takes the place of the bad behaviors, bad habits. And we do that by building in new rituals and building in new behaviors, saying, I'm going to do this instead. When we do our podcast on New Year's resolutions, we're going to be talking about not saying, I'm going to lose weight this year. Okay, well, that's a great goal, I suppose, but it's very nonspecific. What do you mean by lose weight? If you lose a pound next week, is that going to be next year? Is that going to be satisfying to you? Or are you trying to lose 100 pounds next week? Is that going to be what your goal is? So we need to talk about defining what you want to do so that you can build these new rituals and these new habits and elicit the change that you're wanting. But it takes some work. You have to work at it. But we can make that work easier by not relying on the stop system and finding sort of refining our go system, changing our go system to something more adaptive. So if you're feeling stressed and you say, okay, man, I really want to go in there and eat that candy bar. If you don't have a candy bar in there or you have some fruit in there, go eat the fruit. Or if you want to build a new habit of, I really want to go in there and eat that candy bar, but I'm going to go for a walk instead. And the rule is, when I'm walking, I can't eat while I'm walking.
Bring a bag of food.
Right. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's not allowed. One of the things I did, and I've actually done this for a long time. It didn't completely help early on, but was I told myself that as soon as I brushed my teeth for the night, I'm not allowed to eat anything else. And so there were nights that I would try to brush my teeth as early as possible because my rule was, and I did a pretty good job of sticking to it, was once I brush my teeth, I can't eat anything. So if I brush my teeth at, say, 7 o'clock, I'm not going to eat anything else for the rest of the night. And when you create that habit and you create those rules for yourself, and that's sort of what I mean by the ritual. The ritual means when I brush my teeth, nothing else is eaten after that. Or when I'm feeling stressed, I'm going for a walk and I'm not allowed to have food with me when I walk. Or, you know, if you want to, if you want to not get so angry when you're driving your car, then you say, well, when I'm driving my car, I'm going to listen to this or I'm going to listen to that, so that that because that always makes me feel better. That always relieves my stress. Or I know that I'm going to get more likely to get angry if I'm driving on that interstate. So I'm going to find a new route to take so I don't have to drive on the interstate. Mm-hmm. It may take 3 or 4 minutes longer.
That's right.
You and I were talking, we were talking about that in a previous podcast for your drive here to work. It may take a little bit longer, but if it meets the need, meets the goal of decreasing the likelihood of a particular behavior, it might be worth
it. It's worth it. Right.
It's worth it. So, so in creating change down to the moral of the story or the take home message, when you want to make change, you have to begin with acknowledging that we have this internal battle. We have this, you have this drive. No matter how much you believe, your cortex tells you, I don't want to do that anymore.
Right.
You have a subcortical components of your brain that's going to drive you to do it. It never fails. Again, research is very clear that when you tell yourself that you're not going to do something, or you're not allowed to do something, or you're not allowed to eat something, that increases its value, and it's going to make you more and more likely to do it. It's going to make you more and more driven for that thing.
That's right. Right. And when we talk about change, changing habits,
right.
That's what we're talking about. Well, it's common common knowledge now that that it takes about 30 days to create a new habit,
right.
to end an old and build a new habit. And so what we want to caution people about is that when you say, I'm going to lose 10 pounds, and when I do, I'm going to have this reward.
Right.
They're thinking, what's the consequence of losing 10 pounds?
Right.
What they quickly find is the consequence isn't enough to get them through that nightly
right.
thing.
Right.
And so the problem is going to occur every night for 28 or 29 nights.
Okay? Right.
And the likelihood of you battling through that is very, very low.
Right.
And so what we want to do is what you're talking about is, instead of saying, I'm going to give myself this reward, I'm going to buy a new pair of pants or a new dress or a new this or a new that, or I'm going to take myself out, instead of relying on a single consequence like that, you have to come up with things that work tonight.
Right.
You've got to change things that work right now.
Okay? Right.
You can't wait for a month and buy you a new dress.
Right. How many people say, how many times have we heard people say, immediately after the holidays, so right at the first of the year, I'm going to start dealing with this holiday weight that
right.
I gained.
The 8 pounds that I gained over Christmas.
Right. I'm going to start dealing with that so that I can be ready to wear a bathing suit in the summer.
So I'm ready for bikini season.
Okay.
We
that's
live in
six,
Florida.
Six but, months from now.
Or in Florida, it's 4 months from now.
or next week.
You can't say 4 months from now is an eternity.
Right.
You're going to have a battle tonight.
Right.
And you have to figure out what you're going to do tonight to get through tonight.
Right. Okay. And if we just have a little bit of time left, but if you think about this from, we were talking about the different models, and you mentioned the behavioral model.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is, if you battle and battle and battle and battle for 2 or 3 days, mm-hmm. and you do really good,
mm-hmm.
and you say, well, you know what, one night is going to be okay.
That's right.
I don't understand the idea of cheat days.
Right. No.
Because what happens with that is your brain knows, hey, if we struggle hard enough, your brain, again, is working against you.
Right.
Your brain says, if we work hard enough, if we fight hard enough, we will eventually get what we want.
Mm-hmm.
It is more and more difficult to break that habit.
That's right. You just extend the battle.
Right. You say, oh, you know what? Bikini season is four months from now. Mm. It's not going to matter to have a Big Mac tonight.
Right.
Well, your brain just learned, if I really want it, mm-hmm. if I really push, I'm going to get what I want.
That's right.
And so we have to battle that. That's a daily battle. And I like what you said, that you have to figure out what's going to work for you tonight.
That's right.
Every night is one step in the direction that you want to go.
And that's why with children, you know, we advise, don't tell them they're going to get something in a week.
Right.
It's too far. You've got to do something tonight.
Right.
Tonight is the night that you have to do this.
Right.
And you have to do it every night.
Right.
Until the new habit is formed. It might be, new habit might take 15 days, it might take 30 days, it might take 90 days.
Right.
Depends what kind of habit you're trying to build. Not all new habits occur in 30 days.
Right.
Some take 80 or 90 days.
Right.
But you have to get through every day. Each day is a battle.
Right.
That's why AA has one day at a time. That's what that means.
Right. So, and, you know, it's a great point about with kids. Mm-hmm. You know, what do kids want to do when they get home from school? Well, they want to play video games.
Right.
Well, if you allow them to play video games when they get home from school, that's pleasing that underlying system. And so that's what they want to keep doing.
Right.
Then you're going to say, okay, stop playing video games and come do homework. It's probably, for many, many kids, that's not going to work very well.
Transition is very difficult.
So you build the habit of when, and like you said, on a nightly basis. The habit is when you get home, you get your homework done. Once homework is done, then you can play video games.
You know, that's why children have parents. One of the things we didn't mention earlier was that with this go system, these go structures, they develop sooner than the no-go structures.
Right.
So in children, the go structures are there, the no-go structures are not.
Right.
And so they're going to build these habits. They're going to satisfy those needs very quickly. Once you allow a child to get in the habit of coming home and playing video games, then you're going to have to be very careful about, now how do I change that habit when I want him to do when I want her to do homework right after school.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the longer you do it the bad way,
that's right,
the more difficult it's going to be to do it the good way.
Exactly.
So it's good to start that from the beginning.
Right.
Now, if you've already been doing it the bad way, you can get there.
Mm-hmm.
No worries.
Mm-hmm.
The battle is a little bit harder. It may take a little bit longer,
right,
but you can get there.
Mm-hmm.
You just have to be persistent and consistent and predictable every day.
Right. Right.
So when you're thinking about creating change, when you're thinking about changing some of these things in your life, start by, instead of saying, I'm going to stop this, approach it from the perspective is, I'm going to start this new behavior.
I'm going to do these things.
Instead of stopping this behavior, I'm going to start this.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of eating bad, I'm going to eat healthier.
Right.
Instead of losing weight, or instead of stop eating bad so I lose weight, I'm going to work to be, I'm going to make healthy choices.
Right.
And when you make that shift, you're starting on the path of changing those habits to more positive habits, to more adaptive habits to get to the goal that you're working toward.
Right. Yeah, in our practice, we don't talk about diets. We talk about food plans.
Right.
What you need is a new food plan.
Exactly.
Not a diet.
Right, right. And it may sound like it's splitting hairs, but it's so critical.
Right.
We know, again, from research that type of difference in mindset, just the difference in vocabulary, does make a difference. So,
because we know what your brain's going to be doing.
Right.
It's going to be shoving you to donuts and M&Ms.
Right, right. All right. So we'd love to hear from you. If you're working on trying to change anything in your life and you would like to like some support or just a cheering squad or anything like that, we're here. Get in touch with us. Send us an email. Get in touch with us on Facebook or through Twitter. We try to be everywhere. We try. We have our blog and also,
that's right,
you know, get in touch with us. Let us know how you're feeling about things, what you're thinking about things. And we'd love to hear from you and share your experiences with others, because we can all learn from each other and experience this together.
That's right.
The holidays are here, but in the start of the new year, we've got some new things going on here at the office. For those of you who are in this Central Florida area, we've got some groups starting up, social skills groups, both for elementary school as well as middle and high school. We've got some substance abuse groups starting, parents of teenagers with substance abuse issues starting, all kinds of things going on here, parenting kids with ADHD, all kinds of groups happening. January 21st, we are going to have our next workshop, which is on building motivation.
Oh.
So that's going to be a really exciting, very excited about that that workshop. It's going to be here at the office. So go jump on our website, pacflorida.com, and click on the workshops tab, and you will be able to get all that information there as soon as our webmaster gets it posted. I'm the webmaster. So I'll be doing that today, probably. So get in touch with us. Leave us a review on iTunes. That'd be great. We are sneaking up in the rankings a little bit, so it's showing up a little bit more. So please write us a review or rate us so that other people can find us. So, all right, until next week, I'm Dr. Bernie.
And I'm Dr. Richard.
Have a terrific week, and we'll talk to you then. Bye-bye.